This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of March 27th, here are some top stories. It's been more than 2 years since the Arizona Department of Corrections agreed to reform its prison healthcare system. But as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, the DOC is still not in compliance with court orders that affect more than 34,000 people held in Arizona prisons.
The Eighth Amendment to the Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, and that's been interpreted in the courts to entitle prisoners to reasonably adequate health care.
Prisoners can't take care of their own health care needs. They can't go to the doctor themselves. They're locked up. So the state is legally required to provide for their medical and mental health and dental care needs.
David Fati is the director of the ACLU National Prison Project. In 2012, the ACLU sued the state on behalf of a plaintiff class of Arizona prisoners, alleging that the health care provided by the Department of Corrections was so bad that it violated the Eighth Amendment. Jonathan Trethaway is a member of that plaintiff class. He says cruel and unusual is an understatement.
You're made to feel less than human, and you're being neglected, and you're being mentally abused. It feels like you're being tortured.
He spent 7 years in the Department of Corrections struggling with major health issues. After his release, Trethaway founded the Atlas Justice Center to help advocate for the rights of the incarcerated. At a recent board meeting in a Tempe coffee shop, he thinks back to when he first started having symptoms in a Tucson prison.
In my lower left stomach, I was having really sharp pains, and when I would push on that area, I would feel a mass and the pain would increase.
When he started seeing blood in his stool, he put in what's called a health needs request. DOC's own policies say after submitting a request, prisoners are supposed to be seen by a registered nurse within 24 hours. But Trethaway says it was 6 months before he got a response, and two more before he saw a physician.
Who looked at me, asked me to lift my shirt, said that I looked healthy, and then gave me ulcer medication.
The physician told him the swelling in his stomach was probably just gas, but it got worse. Vomiting, cold chills, night sweats. Months went by, and Trethaway's condition got so bad his fellow inmates threatened to riot if he didn't receive medical attention. By the time DOC finally got him to the hospital, it turns out it wasn't gas. It was colon cancer.
My tumor had metastasized to the point where it completely blocked off my intestines, and that's why I was getting sick and got septicemia.
But Trethaway would go on to fight both the cancer and the system. He joined the plaintiff class in Parsons v. Ryan that ended up settling with the Department of Corrections. In 2015, a federal court mandated the DOC comply with 103 stipulations to improve conditions in the state prison healthcare system. But the ACLU's David Fati says recent hearings show that the DOC, which is monitoring its own compliance, just isn't getting the job done.
The picture that is emerging is of a haphazard, make-it-up-as-you-go-along system.
In a statement, DOC says, quote, the ACLU's allegations are unsupported by the evidence. And at a recent status hearing, the state claimed it met the standard for timely access to care for the month of January at all the state prisons it sampled. But Fati says if you look at the same data over the course of a year, DOC is woefully non-compliant. He says recent witness testimony shows that the monitors need more guidance and direction and that their sampling model is anything but random.
I'm reminded of the saying, garbage in, garbage out. If the monitoring isn't being done properly and consistently and rigorously, then the results are meaningless.
DOC contracts with a private healthcare provider called Corizon Health. Spokesperson Martha Harbin says that claims of Corizon and DOC putting off diagnoses and delaying access to treatment are unfounded.
To the contrary, what makes good medical sense and good business sense is excellent and proactive preventive care.
Prison health is public health.
Mark Stern teaches correctional health care in the School of Public Health at the University of Washington. He says even if you don't really care about their rights, keeping prisoners healthy serves everyone's interest.
So that when they come back to society, to the community, they're healthier. They contribute. They don't use up hospitals and emergency rooms and jails. That's a way of caring for ourselves.
Jonathan Trethaway is a testament to that line of thinking. His cancer is in remission, and he's devoted his life to helping others. Because honestly, he feels lucky to be alive.
The yards are full of people with cancer and medical conditions. You see it everywhere. It's so commonplace in prison. And you really feel like you have no voice.
He says it's up to society to speak for them. And it's the responsibility of the state to live up to the Parsons settlement so that prisoners are treated with the dignity and respect they deserve. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The federal government has extended its deadline to April 4th for pitches from businesses who want to help build the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports.
The federal government has given businesses an extra week to express their interest in building the border wall. In the month since the U.S. Customs and Border Protection began receiving bids, more than 600 companies have filed paperwork with the government. But many details about the project are still unclear. Brian Termail is a spokesman for the Associated General Contractors of America.
I think there's a lot of questions about the project, and I think the question in every contractor's mind right now is, where is the money going to come from? And of course, the federal government can't issue a contract to perform any work if the money isn't there.
Many construction businesses expressing interest come from border states. More than 40 from Arizona have filed paperwork with the federal government. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
In business news, Grand Canyon University has undergone a type of renaissance in the past 10 years. New ownership has used a business model that takes online tuition and reinvests that money into physical classrooms and dorms. That explosive growth has upset some neighbors, and as KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports from our West Valley Bureau, the private university is trying to manage those growing pains.
Vibrant Phoenix campus.
Your online degree program puts you
private,
first.
Christian, affordable.
You may be hearing more GCU ads or seeing purple billboards across the valley. Ramping up the school's advertising presence is just one way GCU keeps expanding. More students, more buildings, and more business.
We want to create jobs, and we also want to create revenue streams, which will help us keep tuition as low as possible.
GCU President Brian Mueller is part of the force behind this rapid growth. He credits using the public market to reinvest in the school and the success of their online program. GCU has a diverse list of companies under its masthead, a coffee company, hotel, restaurant, and nearby golf course.
We want to spin off an advertising company run by recent graduates as well.
And the university has been gobbling up property, buying privately owned lots, and working with the city to acquire public land. But some neighbors are not happy, citing a controversial agreement when Phoenix sold the school some land of nearby Little Canyon Park. The park is a popular place for neighborhood kids to play basketball and soccer. Donna Homsher's daughter lived near campus.
We realized it was not if she would sell her house, it would be when.
GCU says they pay above market value for local property. Homsher says it was still nerve-wracking to find a new place along with the ongoing construction nearby. She works with local neighbors to make sure their voices are heard.
We really don't know what to separate out and to fight. What do we take on? We can't take on the whole thing.
Homsher says she will fight to keep the park intact. President Mueller says the university still wants to move the park a few blocks over, but will keep working with the community to hear their input.
If that works for the neighbors, we'll do it. If it doesn't work for the neighbors, we won't do it.
The sprawl of purple buildings and parking has ballooned from 100 acres to 400, a footprint that bears little resemblance to the school sold in 2004. But what remains is its faith-based mission of Christian higher education.
Well, if the university had not been purchased, it wouldn't be there. It would have closed.
Gil Stafford was the president when GCU ownership changed. He's a priest in Litchfield Park now and is thoughtful when considering whether it's remained true to the Southern Baptist founders. He lists off points: rigorous Christian studies, faculty statements of faith, and a campus chapel.
From my standpoint, it has all the characteristics of a particular sense of one of the many strands of Christianity. Is it Southern Baptist? No. But I mean, frankly, that's not the point.
The point, he thinks, is offering higher education among a Christian community that is still present. GCU has reached out to West Phoenix, a historically impoverished area, to employ locals like Jose Salcedo Yaquez. He spent his teens here and heard through his local church that GCU was looking to hire people.
Our church, we've partnered up with them and they help us a lot.
He works at the new hotel and is adamant that the growth has only helped West Phoenix flourish.
Everywhere they're reaching or everywhere they're expanding to is honestly just making it better.
Back at Little Canyon Park, local Donna Homshire is worried those kids won't have a place to play if GCU keeps growing and moves the park. At the playground, a few middle schoolers are hanging out. I ask them about their hobbies and if they want to go to college.
Yeah.
GCU an option?
Yeah.
Really?
Because it's close. And
they just always have stuff going on.
The school hopes by learning from its growing pains, it can provide more opportunities for the young people on the playground and GCU's other neighbors. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now, from KJZZ's original production, The Show, we roll out our new series of conversations from the back seat.
Well, just a few minutes ago, we heard one Sesame Street song, but there's another one. Who are the people in your neighborhood?
Or from Jules Dassin, there are 8 million stories in the Naked City.
Here's another version of that sentiment. One producer drives a cab around the valley and records some of the backseat confessions she hears. Here's one of them.
When you're a cab driver, it all starts like this.
Hello.
Hello.
Regina?
Yeah.
When you're a cab driver with an accent, it goes on like this.
Where are you from? I hear your accent.
Afterwards, it takes all different directions.
My cousin lives in St. Petersburg, and we went to see her. And I'm dying.
And the moment you hear something that clearly stands out among all this noise, you say,
can I record you?
Sure.
No, it's okay. My name is Regina Ravazova. I'm a cab driver and a radio producer. And now you're going to hear what I hear in my car. Here's Bill Biddix. I remember the night I picked him up by the call center he works at. We chatted a bit and he said, it feels as if the doors are finally opening for him after being suicidal for 3 years. But why?
I was going to college and met my wife. She was a multimedia artist, absolutely wonderful woman. Spent 16 years together, fought cancer together, and when cancer decided it wanted to beat her, she fought through chemo radiation the first time. Second time, decided she just wasn't going to do it, and 2 weeks of the day she was diagnosed, she was gone. I had plans with her to open a restaurant. She was going to run the front of the house, I was going to run the back. We had a huge cookbook of handwritten recipes and a whole business plan. We had investors lined up, everything, and then she died. I had planned a lot of things in my life, but being a widower at 35 was not one of them. After she passed away, I taught myself to knit. And I started going to a farmer's market back in Columbus. I was knitting there, had a lot of people asking about it, and ended up turning around selling the teddy bears I was making. Had a couple of policemen and firemen come up to me and say how much they liked them and want to know about possibly getting a few for the young kids that get involved in a situation where, you know, police and firemen have to show up. I ended up donating over 10,000 teddy bears to children's hospitals and firemen, policemen. Now and then, I just came across a kid walking around with one of my teddy bears. I knew he had been through something bad that they ended up getting one, but it made me feel good that I actually provided some kind of comfort to someone I didn't know. It's been difficult over the last few years to find someone that you could even compare to her, let alone replace her. I ended up having to leave the house we shared for 8 years because the memories, the ghosts just kept following me and I was ready to kill myself. It was either I left the state or I left life. I ended up putting a map on a wall, threw a blindfold on and threw a dart, ended up in Phoenix. A lot of people laugh when they hear that, but that honestly is why I'm alive, because I got out of the state. If I hadn't, I wouldn't be. When I got to Phoenix, I put an application out for a job. Got a call back within 5 minutes, had a job the next day. So in my professional life, my personal life, friends, finding a place to live, everything just fell into place. Just nobody to spend time with. I think she's blocking me. She might be a little bit jealous. She was a Leo, so I always feel her presence. Something comes up, she's the first person I want to talk to about it. it always just fixes itself. I can actually feel her in the back seat here. I'm kind of embarrassed. I still see her in my dreams on a regular basis. She comes to me with advice, beats me up in my dreams if I've done something really stupid. Every time there's a blockade in front of me, I get something that just steps around and pushes it out of the way for me. I can only think that my wife is still watching over me, because there's nothing that I've done different here than I did back in Ohio, other than not have her around.
These are the stories from people that live in your neighborhood, that shop in grocery stores near you, that pass you on the sidewalks, that ride in cabs next to you. This is Open Conversation, and I'm Regina Ravazova.
Regina Ravazova is a producer in Phoenix.
And in science news, we head to space via the desert. The Orion Project is planned to take humans to Mars, but before that can happen, NASA wants to send astronauts to the moon for the first time in decades. The space agency recently came to Yuma Proving Ground to test the parachute system for that capsule. Maya Springhawk Robnett of the Arizona Science Desk was on site, and she reports for KJZZ.
It's chilly in the early morning as the Orion Mach capsule is loaded into a C-17 aircraft at the Yuma International Airport NASA hangar. The capsule will be dropped from 25,000 feet. It weighs 22,300 pounds. The mock-up is like the real thing in almost every way, except size. In order to fit into the plane, the mock capsule had to be made 2 feet shorter. But Jared Dom, hardware lead for the Capsule Parachute Assembly System, or CPAS, says that shouldn't affect the test much.
The effect that the vehicle has on the parachutes is what we call the wake. One of the main players in that is the diameter of the spacecraft. So our diameter is representative of the actual Orion spacecraft.
All parachute testing for the Orion capsule takes place at Yuma Proving Ground. And Dom says these tests help them see and understand they can't predict.
It's not like you're driving a car down the road and you get a flat tire, you can get out and change it. If something goes wrong with our parachutes, we have to have the redundancy built into the system.
The tests needed to create that reliability are expensive, according to Carol Evans, the test manager.
It costs between $1 and $1.5 million per test.
The last time NASA came to YPG for one of these tests was in June, and the test was scrubbed or postponed for technical reasons. Evans says that was a loss of about $200,000. Moreover, it cost them time.
We've got 8 tests in this qualification series, and we need to proceed on schedule.
For that same reason, they also hope no changes need to be made. In this qualification stage, the goal is to test the finished product. Harold Robertson, test engineer for CPAS, says one of the major changes made in the previous stage was switching out steel risers for Kevlar ones. A riser connects the parachute to the spacecraft.
They were concerned about the risers getting in contact close with the capsule that had been, warmed up after coming to the Earth's atmosphere. With improved materials technology, we were able to come up with a textile solution that met the thermal requirements, but also saved a lot of weight.
2 days later, in the middle of the desert, surrounded by mountains, a crowd of scientists and media stand under a blue sky waiting for the C-17 to fly overhead and drop the capsule. After more than an hour delay and several flyovers, observers watch the C-17 drop the mock-up. The orange-red parachutes are released, and the capsule floats downward. Arriving at the landing site after a short drive, Koki Machin, chief engineer for CPAS, walks up to the capsule. He's been on this project since it began in 2006. He says when they finally get their project out of Earth's atmosphere, he will be most concerned about the things he didn't think about during the testing phase, the unpredictable things that could happen in space. The U.S. hasn't left lower Earth orbit since the Apollo program, which took humans to the moon and back, ended in 1972. Machin says they have a motto about that project.
We gave out these little bracelets that said, "What did Apollo do?" Because we found ourselves asking that question over and over again. You know, think about this. Don't just press on. Stop, look at the past, learn from it, and make the best assessment from there.
The team plans to wrap up the qualification stage with 6 more tests by 2019. For the Arizona Science Desk, I'm Maya Springhawk Robnett.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the ASU Biodesign Institute, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischmann, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Furke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.